It was early springtime and the strike was on. It drove us miners out of doors, out from the houses that the company owned. We moved into tents up at Old Ludlow. I was worried bad about my children, soldiers guarding the railroad bridge. Every once in a while a bullet would fly, kick up gravel under my feet. We were so afraid you'd kill our children, dug us a cave that's 7 foot deep, carried our young ones and a pregnant woman down inside the cave to sleep. That very night you soldiers waited till all us miners was asleep. You snuck around our little tent town, soaked our tents with your kerosene. You struck a match and the blaze it started. You pulled the triggers of your Gatling guns. I made a run for the children, but the firewall stopped me. 13 children died from your gun.
We heard there an excerpt from Woody Guthrie's song, Ludlow Massacre. Ludlow, Colorado, 1914. It was the place and time at which the conflict between striking miners, coal producers, and the state militia allied with the producers broke out into open warfare. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. The Colorado Coalfield War of 1913-1914 resulted in the deaths of at least 75 people. As for the Ludlow Massacre, historian Thomas Andrews says this. The shooting started around 9 o'clock on a bright, breezy morning in a broad valley where the broken foothills of the southern Rockies tumble down onto the high plains. No one has ever determined who shot first, but participants and witnesses all agreed that within seconds of the initial gun blast, bullets began to fly thick and fast. At some point in the late afternoon or early evening, Ludlow's canvas dwellings caught fire under suspicious circumstances. Soon the whole camp was ablaze. Two women and 11 children perished. 18 strikers were killed over the course of that day. That is in part how Andrews describes what happened on April 20th, 1914, in the opening pages of his book, Killing for Coal, America's Deadliest Labor War. Thomas Andrews is our guest this afternoon. With his help, we'll take a closer look at this deadly strike in war. In his research, Andrews has examined the environmental as well as the economic and social forces that culminated in the violence. Yes, that's right. Environmental forces. Thomas Andrews writes in Killing for Coal that the demand for energy in the late 19th and early 20th centuries was at the heart of the intertwined social, industrial, and environmental histories that sparked the Colorado Coalfield Wars. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. I look forward to your telephone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Thomas Andrews, our guest, is an assistant professor of history at the University of Colorado, Denver. His book, Killing for Coal, America's Deadliest Labor War, is published by the Harvard University Press. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Thomas Andrews, good afternoon. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Celeste.
You point out that there have been two enduring accounts of what happened at Ludlow. Ludlow as battle, and Ludlow, as we heard in the Woody Guthrie tune, as massacre. How did these narratives take shape?
I think they started to form even before the fighting began on April 20th. I think by that spring, the Colorado Coalfield strike had already been going for seven very violent months, and I think that the scripts for these two ways of thinking about Ludlow, I think, were already sort of being written before the fighting had begun that day. one of the things that continually surprised me in my research was just how polarized a situation really existed in southern Colorado. You know, so by April there were really you know, two quite distinct realities in the coal fields, and I think that those distinct realities, you know, on the one hand, sort of the strikers' reality, and then on the other hand, the sort of mindset of the coal companies and the mine guards and the state militiamen who had increasingly become allies of the companies. Those two worldviews had become so ingrained that I think, I think these stories began before the fighting, and the fighting just sort of deepened, sort of confirmed what people in the coal fields had already come to believe about the situation.
Mm. Very explosive situation, like coal dust.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. Now, how did you begin to think that it would be useful to look at the relationships of the various players in this story and their relationships with the natural world?
I mean, the first inspiration was a quite an influential essay by an environmental historian named Richard White, who teaches at Stanford now. And the essay was called "Are You an Environmentalist or Do You Work for a Living?" And at the time, White was at the University of Washington, and he was becoming increasingly interested in the conflict between, or the perceived conflict between, sort of labor, between sort of working people, between jobs, and the protection of environmental resources. You know, it was around the time of the Spotted Owl controversy and so forth. And so White wrote this essay in which he sort of appealed, particularly to environmentalists, to try to do more to consider working people's relationship to the natural world. And so that's what sort of got me thinking about trying to do a project that would integrate labor history and environmental history. And at the time I started this project, which was really sort of mid to late 90s, environmental historians were increasingly beginning to turn their view beyond, beyond the places where environmental history obviously had something to say. So the field had begun looking at things like the conservation movement, national parks, urban pollution. But through that early work, the claim started to develop that when you include nature and history, you can actually understand almost any historical event or historical process in a different and often in a better way. And so I guess this project gave me a way to kind of push that and to try to answer the question, to try to at least explore the question of what could environmental history reveal about something like labor conflict, where it's not immediately obvious what the relationship would be.
Yeah. On the jacket of Killing for Coal, there's a very powerful photograph, striking miners. You want to describe it for us?
Yeah, it's a wonderful image. It's a group of miners arrayed sort of in a horseshoe. And so there's really the feeling that they're sort of surrounding the camera. And they're all heavily armed. Some of them are, they have different sorts of weapons. A couple of them actually have multiple weapons. Several of them are wearing the red handkerchiefs, which gave strikers the name rednecks during this era. And several of them have bandoliers. They're all heights. They're all, very different sort of facial features. Some of them are actually quite well-dressed. Others look pretty scruffy and are wearing coveralls. And this particular group of men had just returned from one of the most devastating attacks in the miners' rebellion that followed the Ludlow Massacre. And so these particular men, from what I've been able to determine, were returning from an attack on a company town called Forbes. So these were striking coal miners who had actually just destroyed a company town about 8 or 9 days after the Ludlow Massacre.
Yeah. Well, as I'm looking at these men, I'm wondering what their view of the landscape would have been. And then maybe we can contrast it to how someone like William Jackson Palmer saw it.
Yeah, I mean, To some extent, I mean that was a question I kept asking myself, and to a considerable extent, I had a hard time finding answers to it, because one of the problems with men like the ones on the cover is that they weren't writing memoirs. Mm-hmm. They often couldn't write at all, and what they could write, they usually weren't sort of waxing eloquent about the beauty of the Rockies and that sort of thing. And so you know, I think I, so to some extent, I don't really know how they looked at the landscape, but I think it, my sense is that when they were on the surface, you know, I mean, they partly viewed the landscape as a place where they could get resources that could make their lives a little bit easier. If you look at the weapons, you know, some of them would have been useful for hunting, and from other research, I know that a lot of the coal miners depended to some extent on the land to sort of supplement their wages. So I think they, you know, I mean, they looked at the landscape and they might have seen jackrabbit and deer and, you know, fishing opportunities to some extent. They also, you know, but the miners by this point also had, they used the landscape for other purposes as well, the surface landscape. By the 1910s, they were using it recreationally, so company magazines are filled with accounts of miners, or, well, mentions of miners going on fishing trips, going on hunting trips, but also having picnics. But the landscape had also, you know, the landscape was sort of a site of workers' power. And in particular, the landscape beyond the fences, beyond the gates of the company towns. And, you know, there's a real sort of connection between company power and the company towns, but outside the company town fences was really more of a workers' world. And so when the United Mine Workers came back into southern Colorado in 1912, a lot of the organizing they did seems to have occurred on hillsides, you know, outside of the company domain. And this built upon a longer history. There was a major strike in 1894, which was organized in a series of groves, which seemed to have been sort of traditional meeting places for coal miners in southern Colorado. And the 1894 strike, like the 1913-14 strike, one of the things that miners really displayed and used to their advantage was a really detailed understanding of the coal field landscape as far as how to get from one place mm-hmm. to another, how to sort of harass their opponents by moving across space. So I think that, you know, I mean, that's sort of their relationship to the surface environment. Now, underground, that gets into a whole different story, which maybe we can talk about later.
Yeah, we will talk about that. In the meantime, though, now we have this other player who's a big player in this book, Killing for Coal, William Jackson Palmer. Tell us just a little bit about him and how he would have seen company domain and how he would have seen the surface landscape.
Okay, well, William Jackson Palmer is a wonderful character. You know, I mean, as a historian, he's the type of person you want to come across, because he, a little bit like Thomas Jefferson, I think, in some ways, he embodied all sorts of paradoxes, and those paradoxes spoke of sort of deeper contradictions, I guess, that lots of other Americans were sort of carrying around in the mid to late 19th century. So to give, you know, I mean, I think that the best example of what a paradoxical figure Palmer is that he became the highest ranking Quaker general in either army during the Civil War. So here's a man who, on the one hand, you know, fervently believes that slavery is wrong, yet on the other hand, maybe it's not an on the other hand, but Palmer also, you know, I mean, his hatred for slavery was so intense, his belief that it was wrong was so fervent that he very early on signed up for the Civil War. And so, you know, I mean, Palmer sort of embodies all of these different things, this sort of, you know, Quaker do-goodism, also a sort of militarism. He was a very very highly regarded mining engineer, and he had also trained with J. Edgar Thompson, who was sort of the leading industrialist. He was the president of the Pennsylvania Railroad, Thompson was, and Palmer had worked as his private secretary for 4 years, you know, alongside men like Andrew Carnegie. And so Palmer kind of combined all of these different roles. And one of the things that really first drew me to Palmer is when Palmer first came to Colorado in 1867 on this little-known expedition called the Kansas Pacific Railway Survey. And that's when he first starts, you know, it's the first time he encounters the Rocky Mountain West. And he's enthralled with it, but he's not really sort of fully, you know, I mean, he's not fully committed to it yet. He comes back to Colorado a couple of years later, though, and by that point he started to express a very fascinating kind of array of ideas. So he was working for the Kansas Pacific Railroad, which was the forgotten competitor to the Union Pacific. So they ended up losing out in sort of the race to build a transcontinental railroad across the continent. That's why people have mostly forgotten about the Kansas Pacific. But during the day, Palmer was their director of construction. And so his correspondence has this really interesting duality where the stuff he's writing during the day is essentially kind of disassembling the Western landscape. He's talking about resources. He's looking at the landscape as a series of discrete things that he can turn into commodities, to either help, either as construction materials or as things that the railroad potentially can carry in the future. And yet at night, he's writing these letters to his fiancée in which he's waxing eloquent about the beauty of the Western landscape. And so, I think this is sort of a telling duality that really reveals a lot about how many elite Americans during this time period were looking at the natural world. On the one hand, it was the basis of their wealth. And then on the other, many of them looked upon it as this refuge from civilization, or as an adjunct to civilization that would make their lives, healthier and better.
Yeah, and he believed in benign monopolization and a benign industrial order, leading to a better society.
Right. And I think that's one of the reasons I chose him to begin the book with, because it's fairly easy to sort of, look at the Colorado Coalfield War as, Gilded Age capital, Gilded Age and Progressive Era capitalism run amok. It's a story about, the excess of laissez-faire. But if you look at where the coal industry in Colorado actually began, it began with this figure who had a really sort of utopian, moral vision for what the coal industry could produce in the West. So Palmer was a man who envisioned harmony between capital and labor. He imagined Colorado as a place where there would never be any strikes, no tension between capitalists and workers, and also a place where, sort of nature and civilization could be aligned and, in perfect accord with each other.
And in light of the disharmony then, how did he feel about the working people, men, women, and children who were the workers?
Well, I think he had a fairly complicated, reaction to sort of what eventually would happen in the world that he helped to create. He was shoved out of his enterprises. Palmer started the Denver and Rio Grande Railroad. He founded the city of Colorado Springs, Durango, Alamosa. He started the Colorado Coal and Iron Company, which turned into the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company, which was the Rockefeller-owned behemoth that was the major player in the 1913-14 coal strike. But Palmer had started all of these things, but by 1884, 1885, he was actually being pushed out of from the management of both his railroad and his coal and iron company. Up until that point, he had been, in practice, he had been fairly unforgiving with his workers. So, a couple of strikes had broken out to that point. And he didn't really seem to, he didn't really seem to walk his talk in those earlier strikes. I think like a lot of businessmen of his era, he viewed sort of charity, especially anonymous charity, as the sort of proper way for an industrialist to mollify the bad consequences of what he was doing. And so, he sort of crafts this really ambitious vision, and yet it's not clear, to what extent he actually followed that vision.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Thomas Andrews. He's the author of Killing for Coal, America's Deadliest Labor War. The Colorado Coalfield War of 1913-1914 resulted in the deaths of at least 75 people. Thomas Andrews, with his help this afternoon, we're taking a closer look at this strike and war. In his research, he's examined the environmental as well as the economic and social forces that culminated in the violence. Listeners, if you'd like to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, we'd love to hear from you. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL 800-222-WILL. WILL. One of the interesting things about William Jackson Palmer was that he was a very bright young man. He was a young engineer, and he realized that one day fossil fuels would be very important. How did he come to that insight? And then help us here think about the importance of coal in the context of what was about to take shape, what was about to happen.
Well, Palmer, I mean, first of all, he was a Pennsylvanian. Born in Delaware, but came of age in Philadelphia. And so he grew up, in the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, and was exposed to sort of the beginnings of the American coal industry. He had an uncle who was quite heavily involved in some of the early enterprises. And so, I think he had some family connections and also just sort of, the Philadelphia of his day, was a place where the early impact of coal was beginning to be felt. But I think the thing that really made the difference for Palmer was a tour he took in 1855. So during that time period, American engineering was really in its infancy. There were just a few engineering schools in the country. For the most part, engineers learned their jobs. They basically learned through experience. And it was quite characteristic during that time period for engineers to take basically an equivalent of the grand tour that American patricians or American artists were, had been taking for a couple of decades. And so Palmer, like many of the other great engineers of the mid-19th century, got on a boat, went across the Atlantic, and then he spent much of a year essentially tramping around Britain with a little excursion to France. And I think it was really seeing Britain in the 1850s that drove this home for Palmer, just how significant coal was going to be. He's coming to England. This is a year after Dickens writes Hard Times. It's a decade after Friedrich Engels is sort of lamenting the plight of the English working class. And I think in England in the 1850s, you couldn't ignore coal, especially if you were an engineer. But one of the things that Palmer appreciated in particular was, many of his engineering counterparts would go around and they would look at, they'd look at railroads or they would look at textile mills. But Palmer was a deeply curious man, and his interest extended then from these textile mills and railroads to the buried depths that were the source of the power, the source of, what almost seemed like a superhuman, supernatural power that was evident in these incredible textile mills and in these great railroads. And so Palmer began exploring the underground world in Britain, and he actually wrote a series of letters. He paid for a lot of his trip, actually, by sending letters back to a newspaper called the Pottsville Miners' Journal back in the Pennsylvania Anthracite coalfields, and Palmer entitled most of these letters Underground Walks in England. He basically was sort of a self-trained expert on the coal industry, and I think had an unusual appreciation for the connection between the sort of subterranean sources of energy and then the sort of radical transformations that coal was powering in England. And in fact, I think he had a better understanding of this than many of the great English economists who'd preceded Palmer in trying to think about the Industrial Revolution.
Mm. And so he takes what he learns and he comes back home, and how does he look out across the landscape at that point? What does he see? How does he see the demand for coal in the United States after the Civil War?
Well, after the Civil War, he started seeing the centrality of fossil fuels to the development of the American West. And I think that when we look back on Western history, it's very easy to kind of get caught up in frontier myths, and also to draw a very sort of straight line from frontier settlement to the modern West. And I think that one of the things that Palmer draws our attention to is that this sort of outcome, that I'm sitting here in Denver in this, massive fossil-fueled metropolis. Palmer didn't see this as inevitable. Instead, he looked at a frontier west where growth, you know, economic growth was very, very slow, if it was occurring at all. It's a region that was it's a region whose economic growth was really hampered by the dryness of the climate and also by the sort of scantiness of the forests. You know, I mean, there just wasn't much energy in frontier Colorado, just as there wasn't much energy in many parts of the West, on the Great Plains and in many mountain regions. The Pacific Coast is kind of a different case, but Palmer looked at this area and saw on the surface a sort of scarcity of energy, but he realized that that surface scarcity could be remedied by the surplus that potentially lay hidden underground. And so what he did then was he endeavored to try to sort of scope out, to survey the energy resources of the West. And so he applied all of these, you know, this sort of this ability to read the landscape and this ability to find coal and to sort of analyze its quality and value. He comes to Colorado and applies what he had learned in Britain and also what he had learned in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And, you know, starts seeing that the Mountain West could actually become something that not too many other folks were imagining it could become. So he started imagining that this region could become a modern industrial, sort of a modern industrial core.
And it strikes me that it is not long before this happens. I mean, in a relatively short period of time, you include, for example, some photographs of Denver in the early 1890s, which it looks like a pretty big city.
Yeah.
And smokestacks and the like. So it wasn't long, really, before we see industrialization in the West. Talk with us about the railroad and coal and the development of cities in the West, a city like Denver, and how coal and the railroad built a city like Denver.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I realized in the course of you know, researching this book and thinking about it was that the railroad's so iconic to how we think about America, but especially how we think about the West. And every picture of a railroad has this sort of inky plume, you know, coming out of the locomotive smokestack. And yet, I don't think we very often think of, you know, what the source of that locomotive contrail, if you can call it that, what the source of that smoke really is. And so one of the things I really try to do in the book is to point out that coal and railroads were really sort of a tandem, and neither did very well without the other. Mm-hmm. And so the sort of success in laying steel rails all across the plains, you know, into these sort of remarkable routes up in the mountains, was inextricably dependent on the exploitation of coal deposits in southern Colorado. And it's, you know, this isn't something that I can really prove, but my suspicion is that if the American West did not have such ample coal reserves, the region's history actually would have looked quite different. But with coal, you know, I mean, railroad travel, railroads could sort of span the region. This made moving goods, moving people, getting information, made all these things cheaper, faster. But railroads, one of the sort of biggest advantages of the railroad was that they could haul really heavy stuff. And, you know, with the help of coal. And one of the things that railroads began to haul very early on in the West was coal. So the railroads started most of the coal mines. Subsequently, they hauled almost all of the coal in the region. But over time, they hauled that coal increasingly to other consumers. And so the rise of a city like Denver depended on coal in all sorts of ways. Coal fueled a lot of the city's most important industries. So Denver was a major smelting center. So gold and silver ore would come down from the mountains and would be smelted in communities on sort of the fringe of Denver. Denver actually had a surprising number of factories, and coal was crucial for that. But the importance of the importance and the impact of coal stretched beyond just sort of, you know, powering basic industries. It actually shaped, I think, the very character of the city and the shape of the city. Denver is a city of brick, as anyone who's been here can attest. And if you look at Denver's location, you know, it's about 20 miles from the foot of the mountains. It's out on the plains. It's on a pretty meager river. There's just not much wood here. There's not much to build with. And, you know, it was coal that powered the brick making that sort of, you know, formed the bricks that made the city. It was coal that turned, you know, that turned various materials into the Portland cement that held those bricks together. So it sort of made up the buildings of the city. But then on sort of still another level, coal really shaped and deepened the inequalities between different residents in Denver and in other cities in the West.
Well, that gets us to the next big topic here this afternoon. So we have this demand for coal, so we have a demand for labor to pull that coal out of the ground. So let's talk about the miners. The miners were a very diverse group. How diverse? Where did they come from?
Well, they were... I haven't been able to find a more diverse workforce in the United States at the time. So there were more than 30 nationalities of miners working in southern Colorado. And these included Asians, African Americans, Northern Europeans, Southern Europeans, Eastern Europeans,
Scandinavians,
Mexicans, people from all
Slovakians,
over.
Slovakians.
Yeah.
Swedes, Swiss. Of course, Brits, the Welsh and the Scots, who had experience with coal
right.
in Britain. What a diverse group. Italians, Mexicans. Did this diversity present challenges in terms of union mobilization and solidarity?
Oh, yeah. It was an immense challenge. And it was a challenge that the companies intentionally set up. You know, it was probably a challenge. The diversity of the coal fields was shaped in part by the sort of openness of mining jobs. I mean, virtually anyone could get a job as a miner. But the companies also encouraged this through their labor recruitment. And so they deliberately set out to kind of set men of different nationalities against each other, or at the very least to just make it difficult for them to speak with each other. And so, you know, you had a real sort of babble underground in any of the coal mines in Colorado. And so overcoming those differences, you know, became the main challenge both for rank-and-file miners and for the succession of unions that tried to organize them.
Yeah. So when and how did they begin to come together and unionize, and what were the issues that galvanized them?
Well, I think the foundations for unionization in the coal fields were really laid underground on the job, and one of the things that I've really sought to do in the book is to emphasize sort of the common miner's experience more than the sort of the story of, you know, union politics and that sort of thing. And what I was really struck by was the extent to which just sort of day to day. You know, the sort of day-to-day culture, the day-to-day labor underground, in various ways created sort of the preconditions for men to start coming together. And so, for example, coal mining tended to be a fairly open industry. And what I mean by that is that experienced miners seem to have felt a real obligation to train inexperienced men in sort of the way of the mines, in the job, but also in sort of the lore and the sort of the culture underground. And so there weren't such hard and fast ethnic divides, at least not underground, as you would see in many other Western industries. And so there was a sort of inclusiveness where men of different nationalities, even men of different races, were working together side by side, often as partners, you know, two men working in one room day after day. And so I think that sort of created laid some of the groundwork for the union movement. But I think that the unions really, they worked when they could channel all of the unrest and all of the discontent that day-to-day labor underground created. And so, I think that the union movement, it really depended on the deep-seated grievances of the miners. And those grievances really had nothing to do with, you know, I mean, they pre-existed the union in a lot of cases, and they endured on the many occasions when unions just abandoned Southern Colorado after defeats at the hands of the companies.
Hmm. What did the miners want? What were their goals? What were they after?
Well, they wanted, they wanted a collection, a sort of assortment of things. On the one hand, they wanted basic civil rights. By 1903, 1904, which was sort of the precursor strike to the 1913-1914 Coalfield War. In both of those strikes, many of the miners' demands were for things like, they were protesting the company's control over local government. They wanted to be able to shop where they wanted to shop. They didn't want to have to trade at the company store. So to some extent, they wanted things that, you know, we could just lump together under freedom. You know, I mean, they wanted to be free of company rule. They also wanted economic advancement, so items on wages and hours and those sorts of things were always part of these strike demands. And then the third thing they wanted was they wanted safer workplaces. I think this is one of the issues where the connection between labor and the environment in my story is the strongest. The Colorado's coal mines were some of the most dangerous workplaces in the entire world in the late 19th and early 20th century. And one of the big sort of impetuses to unionization was that miners wanted to be safe at work, and they didn't believe that they could trust the companies to make them safe. And so their strike demands always included a number of provisions related to mine safety.
Hmm. Tell us a little bit maybe about what life was like underground, what it was to spend a day in a mine.
Well, it was a real sort of mixture, I guess, is, you know, the best way I can describe it. On the one hand, you know, it's incredibly terrifying. Pitch black environment filled with things that could kill you. You know, whether we're talking about explosive methane, explosive coal dust, or you know, the sort of chronic hazards of black lung. Kicking mules, falling roofs. So it was a place filled with hazard and filled with danger, and yet at the same time, it was a place that miners were proud of having, you know, sort of created. And so the workrooms in which miners labored were really these zones of autonomy. Coal miners, you know, I mean, in Southern Colorado, they would set down their tools when a supervisor came into their room. They basically did their own work. They were sort of craft workers still, and they were still paid by the ton. And so it's this real sort of mix of, on the one hand, there were parts of the coal mine environment where miners exercised considerable power, and from which they, derived a lot of pride. I think some of us tend to think of coal mining as sort of a downtrodden occupation, but many miners didn't look upon it that way. Mm. They saw it as an honorable work. And one of the reasons they saw it as so honorable was they knew that this was, you know, they were taking the fuel out of the ground that made the rest of the world go round. So in short, it was sort of a mixture between of sort of autonomy and pride on the one hand, and then on the other hand, this ever-present danger, and then the conflict that danger generated between miners and the companies.
Mm. Thomas Andrews is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's an assistant professor of history at the University of Colorado, Denver. He's the author of Killing for Coal, America's Deadliest Labor War. The book is about the Colorado Coalfield War of 1913-1914. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, we have maybe about 8 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join us with a question, a comment, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, how did the mine operators see the miners' demands, what they wanted? How did the mine operators, the coal producers, respond?
Well, they responded with a couple of things. One thing that the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company in particular, 1913-14, when that strike broke out, they responded that they'd already given the miners most of what the miners asked for. So they had recently increased wages. They had, you know, they claimed to have changed their company store practices. They claimed that they were following state law regarding safety and stuff like that. And so Colorado Fuel and Iron, which was the Rockefeller-owned company and the biggest company in the area, one of the biggest companies in the United States actually at the time, CF&I claimed that, you know, basically the miners' demands were groundless. The one demand, and essentially what CF&I leaders said is they said that this strike boiled down to one thing, which I didn't mention earlier, which was also a frequent demand of miners, and that was unionization. And so the companies basically spun the strike as pure and simple a conflict over whether the coal mines should be unionized, and in particular whether they should be closed union shops or whether the open shop principle would prevail. And then that, you know, so that argument enabled them to make claims of their own about how they were, in fact, the ones who were sort of furthering American freedom and, you know, sort of helping the American workman by making it possible for him to labor without having to deal with the, you know, onerous demands of union overlords and labor aristocrats.
Mm. I've got about three big questions left.
Okay.
So let's start with going back to the Coalfield War of 1913-1914, in particular, the Ludlow and Forbes incidents. That's probably not the right word to use. But anyway, how did the public, the United States public, react to this news, and did it advance the cause of unionization? Did it help the fight for an 8-hour day and so on, or did it retard it?
Well, I mean, this was definitely sort of a national, you know, the strike had already been a national event before the fighting erupted in late April. But Ludlow, you know, instantly found its way onto headlines across the country. I'm fairly certain that it actually appeared in the headlines of the New York Times before it appeared in the Rocky Mountain News, which was Denver's main newspaper. So this was a national event, and I think what it did was it really prompted a national discussion, a national debate over labor rights. I mean that conversation had been going on for a while,
mm-hmm.
but it sort of, you know, revived it and gave it new energy. And so in the wake of the strike, you see everything from Upton Sinclair and sort of, you know, fellow leftists organizing a march on John D. Rockefeller and Rockefeller Jr.'s compound in Pocanico Hills. You know, you see everything from that to both sides in the strike sending participants on speaking tours across the country to sort of present their case in front of others to a federal investigation by what was called the Commission on Industrial Relations. Which in 1915 issued a report which was deeply critical of the Rockefellers. I think it prompted a lot of soul searching. But at the same time, the sort of the underlying issues were definitely not resolved by that discussion.
Let's take a call before we're out of time here. A listener on a cell phone, line one. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I wonder if the background of the wobbly movement in the West influenced the miners any.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the wobblies didn't make many incursions into the coal fields until later, and so the biggest wobbly strike in Southern Colorado was in 1927. The Western Federation of Miners, which was sort of a precursor to the Wobblies, they had tried to take over the coal fields from the United Mine Workers on a couple of occasions. But by the 1913-14 strike, the Western Federation was sort of allied with the United Mine Workers. I think that they did, I think what was most important then was that in this 1913-14 strike, as in the 1903-04 strike, organized labor in Colorado actually managed to present a pretty solidly united front, even though there were pretty big ideological divides between, you know, sort of the WFM side, which was, you know, definitely sort of quite radical, you know, anarcho-syndicalist advocates of revolution and all of that. And the United Mine Workers, which was mostly a sort of bread and butter union. And so, you know, I mean, there was considerable support for the Southern Colorado miners throughout the state. And I think that, you know, the sort of, I mean, Ludlow did deepen the sort of alienation or the sort of disillusion that propelled many Western workers into the Wobblies in the teens and in the 20s.
Yeah. I want to thank the listener for his call, and now we're here at the end of the time we can spend today with Thomas Andrews. And last question, an important one. The demand for energy at this point in time, all these struggles that we've been talking about, lessons for us today, are there parallels?
Yeah, I think there are parallels. You know, I mean, I think it was hard to write a book on energy and violence, you know, in the over the course of the last 9 years without seeing all sorts of parallels with the present day situation. I think the biggest one that struck me was just the sort of, you know, I mean, repeatedly people in Colorado, the public would want to take more responsibility for the environmental and the social consequences of their energy use, and yet they repeatedly failed to do that. And I think to some extent, you know, the fighting at Ludlow, this whole struggle occurred because the people who consume this energy sort of let it happen. So to me, one of the big lessons of this is that we need to take more responsibility for all of the things that go on in the energy hinterlands, you know, where we get our petroleum and our coal and so forth.
Mm. There we have to leave it. Thomas Andrews, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you so much.
Thomas Andrews is an assistant professor of history at the University of Colorado, Denver. His book, Killing for Coal, America's Deadliest Labor War, is published by the Harvard University Press.